history's greatest failed experiment. Performed over 100 years ago, the experiment is named after the two scientists that designed it, Albert Michelson and Edward Morley. The sole purpose of what is now called the Michelson-Morley experiment was to determine whether or not the mysterious ether of the universe does, in fact, exist. The long-anticipated experiment, designed to verify the results of a similar experiment performed in 1881, was the buzz of the scientific community that gathered in the laboratory of what is now Case Western Reserve University in 1887. Ultimately, it held consequences that even the best minds of the late 19th century could never have known. The thinking behind the experiment was innovative, to be sure. If ether really exists, Michelson and Morley reasoned, then the ether must be an energy that's everywhere, and it must be quiet and still. And if this is true, then the Earth passing through this field in space should create a movement, and that movement should be able to be measured. Well, just as we can detect a breeze of air as it ripples through the vast fields of wheat on the Kansas plains today, we should be able to detect the ether's breeze as well. Michelson and Morley named this hypothetical phenomenon the ether wind. The pilot of any airplane will agree that when an aircraft is flying with the currents of the atmosphere, the time to get from one place to another can be much shorter. When the plane is flying against the flow, however, it endures a rough ride, and wind resistance can add hours to the flight. Well, with these metaphors in mind, Michelson and Morley reasoned that if they could shoot a beam of light in two directions at the same time, the difference in the time it took the beams to reach their destination should allow them to detect the presence and the flow of the ether wind. It would be determined by whether or not the beam of light was moving against or with the flow of the ether. While the experiment was a good idea, the results surprised everyone. The bottom line was that Michelson and Morley's experiment detected no ether wind in what looked like the absence of the wind. Both the 1881 and the 1887 experiments seemed to lead to the same conclusion. No ether exists. Michelson interpreted the results of what has been called the most successful failed experiment in history, and he did so in the prestigious American Journal of Science. Quote, "The result of the hypothesis of a stationary ether field is thus shown to be incorrect, and the necessary conclusion follows that the hypothesis is erroneous." So while this sounds very complex, the bottom line to this experiment is that no ether field was detected. And while the experiment may have been described as a failure regarding proof of the ether, in fact, it simply proved that the ether field might not behave quite the way scientists originally expected. Just because no movement was detected does not mean that the ether isn't there. An analogy for this experiment would be to hold your finger above your head to test for the wind. If you concluded that no air exists because you felt no wind in the moment of the test, that would be a rough equivalent of the thinking behind the conclusions of the 1887 experiment. And of course, we know that that's simply false. Accepting this experiment as proof that ether does not exist, modern scientists now operate upon the assumption that things in our world happen independently of each other. They accept that what someone does in one part of the world is completely unrelated to the rest of the world and has no effect upon someone else half a planet away. Arguably, this experiment has become the basis for a worldview that has had a profound impact on our lives and even our planet. As a consequence of this kind of thinking, we govern our nations, we power our cities, we test atomic bombs and exhaust our resources, believing that what we're doing in one place has absolutely no effect anywhere else. Since 1887, we've based the development of an entire civilization on the belief that everything is separate from everything else, a premise that more recent experiments show today is simply not true. Over 100 years after the original experiment, new studies suggest that the ether, or at least something like it, does in fact exist. It does not appear to be in the form that Michelson and Morley had expected, however. Believing that the field must be motionless and made of electricity and magnetism, just as other forms of energy that were being discovered in the mid-1800s were, Michelson and Morley searched for the ether just as they would a conventional form of energy. But ether is far from being conventional. In 1987, the very prestigious journal Nature published an unassuming report simply titled Special Relativity, with implications that absolutely shake the foundation of the Michelson-Morley experiment, as well as everything we believe about our connection to the world described another experiment that was conducted by scientist E.W. Silvertooth, and it was sponsored by the United States Air Force, duplicating the 1887 experiment, but with equipment that was much more sensitive. Silvertooth reported that he did detect a movement in the ether field, and furthermore, it was precisely linked to the motion of the Earth through space, just as Michelson and Morley had predicted nearly 100 years earlier. This experiment and others suggest that the ether does, in fact, exist, just as Max Planck suggested in 1944. Although modern experiments continue to indicate that the field is there, we can be sure it will never be called the ether again. In scientific circles, the mere mention of the word conjures up adjectives ranging from pseudoscience to hogwash. As we'll see in the next chapter, the existence of a universal field of energy that permeates our world is being thought of in very different terms. The experiments that prove its existence are so new, in fact, that a single name is yet to be chosen. So regardless of what we call it, something is definitely there. It connects everything in our world and beyond, and it affects us in ways we're only beginning to understand. So the question is, how could this have happened? How could we have missed such a powerful key to understanding how the universe works? Well, the answer to this question cuts to the very core of the quest that's created the greatest controversy and the most heated debates among the greatest minds of the last two centuries. It's a controversy that continues to this day, and it's all about the way we see ourselves in the world and our interpretation of what we see. The key here is that the energy that connects everything in the universe is also part of what it connects. So rather than thinking of the field as separate from everyday reality, the experiments now tell us that the mundane, visible world actually originates as this field. It's as if the blanket of the divine matrix is spread smoothly throughout the universe, and every once in a while it wrinkles here and there into a rock or a tree or a planet or a person that we recognize. Well, ultimately, all of these things are just ripples in the field. This subtle yet powerful shift in thinking about the field is the key to tapping the power of this divine matrix in our lives. If we're going to do so, however, we must understand why scientists view the world as they do today. Different rules for different worlds. Science is simply a language to describe the natural world and our relationship to that world and the universe beyond. And it's only one language. There have been other languages. Languages such as alchemy and spirituality, for example, that were used long before modern science ever came along. While they might not have been sophisticated, they certainly worked. And I'm always amazed when people ask me the question, what did we do before science? Did we know anything about our world? Well, the answer is certainly yes, a resounding yes. We knew a lot about the world, and we knew what we knew in a way that worked so well that it provided an entire framework for understanding everything from the origin of life to why we become sick to what we do when we get sick, and how to calculate the cycles of the sun, the moon, and the stars. While this kind of knowing was obviously not described in technical language like we use today, it did a pretty good job of providing a useful story of how things work and why things are as they are. So good, in fact, that civilization existed for over 5,000 years without ever relying upon science, at least science as we know it today. Science and the scientific era are typically acknowledged as beginning in the 1600s. It was in July of 1687 that Isaac Newton formalized the mathematics that seemed to describe our everyday world, and he published his classic work entitled Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, which loosely translates to Mathematic Principles of Natural Philosophy. Well, for over 200 years, Newton's observations of nature were the foundation of the scientific field that we now call physics. And along with Maxwell's theories of electricity and magnetism in the late 1800s, Einstein's theories of relativity from the early 1900s, this classical physics has been tremendously successful in explaining the large-scale things that we see in our world, things like the movement of planets and galaxies and apples falling from trees. It's actually served us so well that we were able to calculate the orbits for our satellites. We even put a man on the moon based on this kind of thinking. During the 1900s, however, something changed. Advances in science revealed a place in nature where Newton's laws just don't seem to work. The very small world of the atom. Before then, we simply didn't have the technology to peer into this subatomic world or to watch the way atoms behave during the birth of a star in a distant galaxy, for example. In both realms, the largest and the smallest, scientists began to see things that could not be explained by the traditional physics, by Newton's physics. A new kind of physics had to be developed with rules that would explain the exceptions in these extremes, hence the birth of quantum physics. The definition of quantum physics is found in the name itself. The word quantum is defined as a discrete quantity of electromagnetic energy. It's the very stuff our world is made of. So quantum physics is really about the study of everything in our world, what it's made of. We reduce it to its most elementary essence. Quantum physicists soon found that what looks to us like the solid world really isn't so solid at all. Maybe the following analogy will help us to understand why. When the local movie theater projects a moving image on the screen in front of us, we know that the story we're seeing is an illusion. The romance, the tragedy that tug at our heartstrings are actually the result of many still individual pictures being flashed very quickly, one after another, to create the sense or the illusion of a continuous story. So while our eyes do see single pictures frame by frame, our brain merges those single pictures into what we perceive as this nonstop movement. Well, quantum physicists believe that our world works much in the same way. For instance, what we see is the football touchdown or the triple axel of a figure skater on a Sunday afternoon sports program, in quantum terms, is actually a series of individual events that happen very quickly and very closely together. Similarly to the way that many images strung together make a movie look so real, life actually occurs as brief, tiny bursts of light, and these bursts are called quanta. The quanta of life happens so quickly that unless our brain is trained to operate differently, like in some forms of meditation, it simply averages all of the pulses together to create the continuous action that we see as the Sunday sports. So quantum physics, then, is the study of things that happen on the very small scale of the forces that underlie our physical world. The difference in the way that the quantum world and the everyday world seem to work has created two schools of thought among scientists in contemporary physics, the classical and the quantum. And each school has its own theories to support it. So the great challenge of our time has been to marry these two very different ways of thinking into a single view of the universe, a view that we call the unified field theory. To do so requires the existence of something that fills what we think of as empty space. But what could that be?